Lee Morgan, as you are now, if you're familiar with the Taylor Report, you're familiar with Lee Morgan, Sidewinder. And I would remind you that the Taylor Report is on Facebook and on SoundCloud, the Taylor Report. And you can write to us, the Taylor Report at CIUT.FM. I have graduated to that point. So you can now check us out, write, tell us what to report, tell us what we missed. It's all up to you. I should mention also very quickly, we recently lost a former programmer at CIUT named Suhair Kashmiri. He used to write feature articles for the Globe and Mail, had a column at Now Magazine, and he was a great pleasure to work with. We broadcast caffeine-free Tuesday mornings, and I learned a lot from the guy. He was a great friend of CIUT, great friend of our show, and we're very sorry he's gone. And in a few weeks, we're going to talk about Suhair's career. But I believe we're joined now by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes. Hello, Phil. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Stephen has a great blog at gowans.wordpress.com, and it has a new article at What's Left. It's called When Liberal Democracy Meets Plutocracy. And, Stephen, it seems very timely. You point out that those who think that they need to guide us, particularly the New York Times, Washington Post, Globe and Mail, and others, they've been talking lately about a worry they have about maybe democracy getting out of hand. And you quote Mr. Fisher in the New York Times. The way you pose the question is Western politicians and major news media say that the liberal democratic order is under threat. But what do they mean by liberal democracy? So that's, you pose a good question. What do they mean? What is this difference between liberal democracy? Most people probably wouldn't think it needs a qualifier.
Yeah, and Max Fisher at the New York Times, whose job is to explain the background of contemporary or current events, has taken it upon himself in two articles recently to explain to the rest of us, the great unwashed masses, what liberal democracy is really all about. Because according to Max, we don't know. We're mistaken. We think that democracy is ruled by the people.
And we the people. That's probably where they got the wrong idea.
Yes. And he says there's a vision of democracy as ruled by the people, and it persists, and that's a problem, in his view. So he took it upon himself to disabuse all of us of why that's a problem and what democracy really is. So he explains that, and I think one of the reasons he's explaining this is because he says, you know, a lot of people have become disaffected, alienated from democracy because they seem to have come to the conclusion that it's not really responsive to the popular will. So they're becoming alienated. They assume that the system will respond to the will of the majority. But then he goes on to say, but that's not the way it's supposed to work. Liberal democracy doesn't work that way. Instead, he says, there are checks imposed on the popular will, which can make it feel like democracy is failing. But this is actually the way the system is working. It's working as intended. And so he introduces the idea of universal rights and the common good. And he juxtaposes that against majority rule and suggests that majority rule is inimical to universal rights and the common good. So the common good and universal rights have to be protected from the people because the people might encroach upon that. So who defines the common good and who protects it? Well, institutions and representatives, he says. And I guess a good example of this might be the whole idea that the central bank and monetary policy ought to be independent of parliamentarians. or legislative bodies or the will of the people, because only central bankers can know the common good. And therefore, the common good, as defined by the central bankers, must be insulated from the will of the majority. Mm-hmm. And so he's simply building on that idea to tell us that we shouldn't expect that our votes and the majority will and the popular will should guide government policy, because government policy needs to be guided by these institutions and representatives that are better placed to define the common good than we are, which is a rather peculiar view of democracy. That seems to be actually the antithesis of democracy. Mm-hmm. So when he talks about a liberal democracy, he's really talking about something that is other than a democracy, but borrows the word democratic to make it sound legitimate.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I mean, reading your article, I was struck by the fact that he would cite Edmund Burke.
Yes.
You know, I thought, well, you might as well throw in Hamilton. Hamilton said there should be a president for life and a Senate for life because you couldn't trust the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not a wing of American thought that was supposedly prevailing. They were called Tories. This seems like a nakedly Tory theory, even though it's called liberal.
Yeah. And what struck me about this analysis or this presentation is that it amounts to a Marxist analysis of liberal democracy in many respects. I mean, it's analytically similar. It doesn't use a Marxist idiom, mm-hmm. but it essentially describes liberal democracy in the way many Marxists would. The mm-hmm. difference is that what a Marxist might condemn as being, you know, bad, he regards as good. It's just turned everything on its head. A Marxist might say, well, you know, this is what we've already said. In fact, who is it that establishes these checks and institutions? He doesn't leave this undefined. He says it's the establishment that does that.
Mm-hmm.
The establishment has to be able to negate the majority view for the system to work, which is kind of like a Marxist view.
Yeah.
And it's also empirically or consistent with some research. There's a study done in 2014 by two U.S. political scientists. They looked at 1,700 U.S. policy issues, and they looked at, well, who's influencing these issues and what's the outcome of them? And their conclusion was that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests, so in other words, the establishment,
mm-hmm.
has substantial impacts on government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no influence.
Yes.
So empirically, I mean, this backs up Fisher's analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And also people seem to recognize this. There has, since 1958, been this survey conducted by the University of Michigan, which asks people every 2 years in the United States, would you say that the government is pretty much run by a few big interests looking out for themselves, or is it run for the benefit of all people? Well, recently, I mean, in this century, most people have been saying it's been run for a few big interests.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Fisher saying this is the way it is mm-hmm. in the New York Times. We have empirically, we have research that says, yes, this is the way it is. And then we have most people recognizing that this is the way in which the system works. The only difference between what most people think and what the New York Times think is that most people would say a system that's supposed to be democratic, that is not responsive to the popular will, is not something we want. Whereas the New York Times says, oh, yes, that's something that we want, and everyone should recognize that they shouldn't expect, you know, the majority view to prevail.
Yeah. It is a startling thing to have be staring it in the face and have Mr. Fisher paint it so clearly and then say, and that's a good thing.
It's, yeah.
You know, I could see a lot of people maybe in Paris standing outside his office saying, come out here and talk to us about it. We're actually seeing a kind of plebiscite going on in France where they say, you know, you cannot impose on us. And he said, yes, I can. And I'm doing it for your own good. That's his position. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. And Stephen, by the way, has three really great books written about Korea and the Syria matter, which seems to be going rather well for the time being. And then and there's a new book coming out about Israel. Stephen, you didn't use a word. I was wondering almost why. They've certainly been ringing the alarm bells about something they call populism. They really don't like populism at the headquarters of the New York Times elsewhere.
No, they don't like populism, and for precisely the reason that Fisher says, because it's a vision of democracy as ruled by the people. It's a vision of direct popular rule. And as he argues, democracies, quote, are not designed for popular rule. They are designed, quote, to resist it. Again, Akiria's argument is saying, hey, you know, you never understood what democracy was. It's not what you think it is.
Yeah,
it's actually tyranny. They go on, and he goes on to make the claim that, in fact, majority rule is a tyranny. It's a tyranny of the majority over the minority, a tyranny of the majority over the establishment.
Yeah, you know, and you used the old expression, the unwashed. The gentlemen like Fisher, and certainly the people in the high rise, the high shiny buildings in Washington, New York, they really do not like, and they certainly fear the people. There's something scary about the masses.
Yes, absolutely. And their view is that the people cannot define their own interests. It's up to the establishment
people
to define
know best.
The interests of the people.
Uh-huh.
And this is not new. I mean, in the 70s, we had the whole idea of the crisis of democracy that the Trilateral Commission had put forth, suggesting there was an excess of democracy, and the excess of democracy made it difficult for governments to govern. But there are other times when there are excesses of democracy, or the establishment believed there were excesses of democracy. I mean, this happened in the 1920s, or at the end of the First World War in Italy, or in 1930s in Germany, when the establishment believed there was an excess of democracy and something had to be done about it. And what was done about it was fascism.
The ultimate cure for democracy. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, and on this word, I wish the word plutocracy was much more in use. I once was at a conversation attended by accident, with Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States, and former leader of the Parti Québécois, and the leader, they were getting to know each other, and the retired leader said to Ramsey, I don't understand your country. Why does money be allowed to play such a big role? Ramsey's answer was, we are, in fact, a plutocracy.
Uh-huh.
That ought to be repeated more. You know, it would kind of probably stick in the ear of the ordinary person once, you know, don't you think, if we would insist on it because it's more descriptive than democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what the New York Times is essentially saying, that this system is plutocratic, but we call it democratic. By sticking the modifier liberal before it, but it's really a plutocracy.
It's sort of like a benign dictator, right? I mean, actually, you quoted Henri Barbusse, one of my favorite authors, talking about how, you know, the president is actually just a king in a different outfit in the capitalist system.
Yes, we replace a throne with an armchair, but it's still a tyranny of economic elite over the majority.
Stephen, I think we really ought to maybe transfer a segue from this to, I want to ask you about Venezuela. It's rather ironic that the Prime Minister of Canada and the President of the United States, coincidentally it turns out, both recognized the leader of the National Assembly of Venezuela as the president of Venezuela. And the name of his party is the People's Will Party. So how about that? They don't believe in the people's will for themselves, but they let a guy who claims to be the people's will. They want him to be the president of Venezuela. It's, by the way, I can't, you know, you brought up the word fascism. This is all so overt and naked and in your face, the way they're doing this. It seems possible to provide any particular analysis than to say the bullies have gotten together and they've just decided they're going to remove the government of Venezuela.
Yeah, and you're right. It is naked and in your face. And just something that's happened so many times before. But I mean, we have Maduro, for example, saying that calling Juan Guaido, the the self-declared president of Venezuela, a treasonous figurehead of a plot orchestrated by the United States to capture Venezuela's vast oil reserves on behalf of wealthy U.S. investors. And, you know, it's a summary of what's happening. Maduro couldn't have done much better. I mean, there's a Canadian press report. If you look at, in fact, many of the reports in the mainstream newspapers, they're all consistent with Maduro's analysis. I mean, we had this Canada press report pointing out that Canada and other members of this so-called Lima group encouraged the opposition to find a new face without political baggage around whom it could unite, which is just the standard U.S. regime change plan, which they've used before in Yugoslavia and in Zimbabwe.
Libya, Syria, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, they select this young unknown person who, in fact, is so unknown that one poll indicates that most Venezuelans had never heard of him. Then he slips into Washington to secretly meet with the Trump administration, presumably to secure its blessing. Then he's back to Venezuela, where the opposition follows through on this Lima group's, what's obviously a prearranged plan, to elect him head of the National Assembly. And again, according to a recent poll, the body has a 70% disapproval rating in Venezuela. Then he declares himself president. Also, one gathers, part of this preconceived Lima group plan. And, you know, the fact that Guaido is Washington and Ottawa's and not Venezuela's man, I think, is evident not only in his plotting with, you know, hostile foreign powers and his obscurity in Venezuela, but also he's put forward his plan to revive the country's economy, which has been destroyed by Western sanctions. And according to the Wall Street Journal, his plan for opening up or his plan for reviving the economy is to open up Venezuela's vast oil sector to private investment, to privatize assets held by state enterprises, and to revive the private sector. So,
That moved a Globe columnist to say that he's a socialist. You say, boy, you can write anything at the Globe. I mean, the guy may as well have turned in a cartoon.
But this is a plan to end socialism, right? A plan to surrender Venezuela's economic sovereignty and to turn over the country's, you know, natural resources to private foreign investors. So is it any surprise that the United States and Canada, I mean, home to big oil and big mining, have taken a leadership role in backing Guaido? I mean, if we carried through on Guaido's plan, you'd just re-Americanize the Venezuelan economy. So you'd reverse the efforts of the Bolivarian Revolution, you know, initiated by Chavez, backed by Venezuela's poor. And that would be a great boon for U.S. oil companies. And that's a matter U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton alluded to in a recent television interview. Canadian mining companies would make off like bandits.
Pretty apt. We could, you know, we could probably drop like.
Yeah.
Just remind people, it's Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, you must have seen this column. There's a new site called grayzoneproject.com and Max Blumenthal. has written a very interesting background piece on who Mr. Guaido is. And I'll bet you recognize an entity there known for its promotion of color revolutions. You want to talk about that? What, you know, in other words, he didn't, this is not just a guy who just popped up. He has an interesting history. He's been working for a number of years with the guy, what's it called, the Einstein Group or what? The one who claimed to have overthrown Libya and Syria or whatever.
Yeah. And then part of the National Endowment for Democracy, which the first head of that group, which is funded by the U.S. government, the first head
entirely
of
entirely separate, of course. They just give them the money and never ask them what to do.
Yeah. Well, this was described as the National Endowment for Democracy does what the CIA used to do, but it does it openly, which is essentially funnel money and organization and assistance to opposition groups in countries where the United States wants to overthrow the government. So, yeah, reading about Guaido on that site, I was reminded of work I'd done previously and looking into the same kind of thing that was done in Zimbabwe and in Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. Guaido was involved in these programs, receiving training on essentially how to do nonviolent regime change. Mm-hmm. The whole idea is to try to to undermine the legitimacy of the existing government. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's what's happened here. I mean, the whole idea is to suggest that Maduro is illegitimate, that his election was fraudulent, and therefore that someone else can claim or legitimately claim to be the president in his stead.
I have to ask you one last question that I've been, I would say, riddle me this. The American media, and you've described them as delusional, and I think it couldn't be more accurate. You said the delusional writing, whatever, the pundits. The picture we get is that Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, New York Times, across the board, Trump is a might actually even be an active agent of Putin. He's under Putin's influence. So I have to ask you, why does Putin want Trump to overthrow the government of Venezuela?
Yes, exactly.
This must be one hell of a plan. I just figured you could help us out with it.
Yes, it's quite a conspiracy theory.
I'll leave that as a rhetorical question. Stephen, it's been great talking to you. Your writing is right on the money on this thing. And actually, we look forward to your comments about the Lima Group and the other criminals. Thanks very, very much.
Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
Okay, bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT. Hey, again, you can write to us, thetaylorreport@ciut.fm. And make sure you check out Eva Bartlett and Vanessa Bealey, Charmaine Narwani. And this, I just mentioned, thegrayzoneproject.com. Take a look and find out who Mr. Guaido is. And I guarantee you, you'd never vote for him. This is Taylor Report. Got to thank Jessica, and we'll see you next week.